Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find the new season of Here Be Monsters on August 17th at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
We have done so much more than survive. We have thrived through difficult times, overcome obstacles, and continue to produce steady gains year after year after year. LA Unified, we are a district on the move.
That was LAUSD Superintendent Michelle King this morning giving her first State of the District address. She touted the highest graduation rate ever. She talked about expanding arts education, language, and technology in classrooms. She talked less about how the district would go about accomplishing these goals. Howard Bloom covers education for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
So every year the superintendent gives a State of the Schools speech a week before classes start, and you've listened to them for years. Anything stand out in this one for you?
Well, you know, there wasn't much that I hadn't heard from her before. I think this was kind of a greatest hit speech, and not everybody would be expecting that a speech about LA Unified would be a greatest hit speech because they look at LA Unified and see a lot of problems, but that was not the tone of the speech today. It was, I think that clip you chose was very representative. It was kind of like, you guys are doing a really good job, but we need to do even better, and we're on our way to do it. And again, that's not the message everybody would take as the most relevant of LA Unified, but that was the message that the superintendent had for the troops today. And the troops, by the way, were essentially administrators as well as civic dignitaries in the press.
Right. And the big talking point was the high graduation rate and of 75%, which is pretty remarkable given that in December, about half of all seniors were in danger of not getting a diploma. So what, explain that for us and explain this mysterious thing called credit recovery efforts.
Well, the district has adopted a variety of credit recovery efforts. Some of them are online. I mean, there's the traditional credit recovery. There's summer school. There's adult school. There's concurrent enrollment, night school, all sorts of things. And there have been a lot of questions raised about whether all of this credit recovery was rigorous enough, academically rigorous enough. But it was a concerted effort from top to bottom of the district to find some way to get these students to graduate. And we never knew it was that easy to get students to graduate before.
Yeah, right. Exactly. If only. It's like education on steroids. And that has elicited the charge that this graduation record is inflated. And that's perhaps a result of creative accounting. Is that fair?
I don't know about creative accounting, but in fact, I
so
would probably not creative accounting in term, because I have written stories about schools that did creative accounting on these matters. But it's more of a question of whether all of these programs, say, if you're redoing an English class, is that English class a real English class equivalent to the one that you failed earlier that represents redoing the work? I mean, one of their credit recovery methods is to have students do just enough added work in a class that they failed in the past to get over the pass line. I mean, is that what we consider credit recovery, earning a credit? Maybe that's okay. Maybe not.
Well, on to the other controversy, which is that King talked a lot about programs for needy students, English learners, foster kids, homeless students. But just this week, state education officials said the LAUSD isn't properly accounting for $450 million that's supposed to be earmarked for these kids. So tell us about that.
Yeah, okay. You may be sorry you asked this question, but it's really complicated, but I'll try to keep it simple. The state's new funding formula, which is giving a lot more money to districts like LA Unified, is this new money is based on adding services for English learners, kids from low-income families, and foster students. And if you've If you can prove that you are spending extra money on these kids already, then you can use the new money that the state is giving you for other purposes. And that's the dispute. LA Unified says, hey, we're already giving these kind of students extra services, so we can take this new money and use it for whatever we want, which will also benefit these kids. And some advocates are saying, no, you're not reading this correctly, and in fact, you're misspending this money, and you have to focus this money instead exactly on those targeted students. So that's what that dispute is about.
And is the takeaway about trust, and what should we make of this outside of the district wars?
Wow, what should we make of this? That LA Unified still has lots of problems, despite what Michelle King says. And I think Michelle King would acknowledge this in another setting, perhaps, that there's questions about the district's very survival, its solvency. There's charter growth and the growth of charter schools, which are not run by the district. And every time a student leaves the district for a charter school, it creates a little bit of a budget issue.
Right. And let's pick up on that issue with our next guest, John Rogers. He's an education professor at UCLA and director of UCLA's Institute for Democracy, Education, and Access. Good of you to join us.
My pleasure, Barbara.
And my guest was just speaking of this challenge of charter schools draining revenues from the school district. Is that the biggest challenge that the superintendent faces moving forward?
I think it's a huge challenge. In the last decade or so, you've seen a dramatic rise in the number of students in Greater Los Angeles enrolling in charter schools. And that growth has largely been fueled by a handful of funders who've been trying to dramatically overturn the way schooling's been done in Los Angeles, including Eli Broad.
Well, how does the threat of charter schools in LA compare to what's going on in districts around the country and around the state? Is this truly a national education crisis or a transition point, or is this something very special to LA?
It's a little bit of both. So across the state, across the nation, you see a growth of charter schools in the last 25 years. In the last decade, the growth in charter enrollment in Los Angeles is unequaled anywhere else in the country. So Los Angeles now enrolls more students in charter schools than any other city by far, almost twice as many as the next highest city in the country.
Well, what is your prognosis for the district going forward now? We heard a lot of promises, a lot of exciting a call for progress from the superintendent. What's your prognosis?
Well, I think it really depends. It depends on whether we're going to continue down a pathway that Eli Broad is encouraging of greater competition across different schools that really leaves many communities without the opportunities that are needed for educational excellence, or whether we try to construct a public education system that's serving all of the 750,000 or so young people that are attending school in Los Angeles. If we attend to the broader needs of this larger group of students and we think about their needs as a whole, we're going to create a public education system that's high quality and equitable for everyone.
And what are you hearing from the superintendent then today in this speech? And I'm thinking this is King's first year on the job, and coming in, she was known as a bureaucrat, a district team player, but not necessarily someone with a clear vision of her own. Did you hear vision in today's speech?
Well, as Howard said, I heard a lot of optimism. I think she's in a difficult position on a couple levels. One is that she replaced someone, John Dacey, who was critiqued for an autocratic style. So she's trying to be more inclusive of many different voices, which I think is a terrific thing. Her other challenge is that she's facing this existential threat from charter expansion. And so faced with that threat, she is trying to put a very positive face forward. I think it's critical at this moment to continue to hail the successes of the district, but to talk in a really meaningful way about the need to proactively create this larger system that includes everyone and that really challenges the charter schools to be part of a broader system of public education.
And finally, what were your thoughts as you hear the district celebrating a 75% graduation rate?
Well, I heard the discussion you had with Howard, and I agree that there's a need to be attentive to whether students are really being prepared for college. I do want to say that the successes to date are successes. in the sense that back 10 years ago, when we first started looking at graduation rates in Los Angeles, less than half of all entering ninth graders were graduating 4 years later, and that was with a lower set of standards. So the very hard work of young people, of their parents, of educators, has improved things. We just still have a long way to go.
John Rogers, he's an education professor at UCLA. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Barbara.
And Howard Bloom also joined us. He covers education for the LA Times. Thanks, Howard.
Sure.
Are you an LAUSD parent, student, or teacher? What do you think the district's top priority should be? Let us know at 844-PRESS-PLAY or on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Now turning from education to the economy. Over half of Americans think raising taxes for the rich is a good idea, and historically it's proven to be a good way to remedy inequality. So why is the task of raising taxes so difficult? And what does history tell us about what it does and does not do? Alana Semuels is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She's written a piece called "Is the U.S. Due for Radically Raising Taxes for the Rich?" Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you point out that until fairly recently, income taxes were much higher than they are now, which right now it's less than 40%. At times, they've been as high as 70% for some people. So remind us when that was and whether it resulted in a more even distribution of wealth.
Sure. Well, as people must know or might know, that the first income tax wasn't established till 1913 in the U.S. So before that, there was no income tax. Then in 1913, income tax starts is pretty low, 7%. 1917 jumps up to 67%, kind of goes up and down for the 20s. And then in the 30s, it jumps to 79%, actually gets up to 91% for people in the top bracket in the 40s and 50s. And even part of the 60s goes down to 70%. And it's pretty high until Ronald Reagan gets into office and starts lowering it slowly.
You know, so, my jaw is dropping. I think other people's jaws are dropping, too. I don't think any of us remember a 91% income tax.
Yeah, it's pretty astounding if you look at how long the income tax was above 70% for the top bracket. I mean, it was decades upon decades. And these were decades when the U.S. was undergoing some of its biggest economic expansion ever. You know, you think of the 50s as this kind of halcyon time of a wonderful economy. And throughout the 50s, the income tax for the top bracket was at 91%.
Well, I'm thinking that most people think of the U.S. as a place where getting rich is a positive goal and being rich is admirable. And we're hearing that, or perhaps seeing it play out in this election. But you also talk about this time when the idea that earning a ton of money was in some ways vulgar or unfair, and it made possible these higher taxes on the rich. When was that and what changed about our thinking about wealth?
A lot of research on taxes and what it takes to raise taxes or eradicate income inequality revolves around wars and mass mobilization. And it's kind of the same in America. I think you had, especially after the Gilded Age and after the stock market crash, in the 20s and 30s, there kind of arose this idea that there had been people that had been allowed to kind of abuse their wealth and had been able to get too much wealth. And then the country started gearing up for the war and really kind of pulled together. And there's this idea that the rich should be paying more, especially because the country needed money for war. But I think that really lasted for a couple of decades after the war, even, this idea that too much money, there was such a thing as too much money, and it was the government's role to make sure that this was more evenly distributed than it had been.
So that helped mobilize political will. What else helped mobilize political will for a radical raising of taxes? Give us an example.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was really curious how taxes jumped so high. And so I looked at 1932, which is when they jumped from 25 to 63%, which seemed to me like a pretty dramatic jump, especially in a country that wasn't even that used to having an income tax. And what happened there was the U.S. was still on the gold standard. So this is kind of a different time in which, you know, any currency manipulations would mean it would be a big deal for the economy. If the U.S. went into significant debt, it would significantly devalue the currency. And so President Hoover looked around and said, we're about to have a gigantic deficit. We might have to print more money. And a lot of people said, you know, if you print more money, this is going to be a big problem. We don't want to have a deficit. We don't want you to print money, so go ahead and raise taxes on the rich. And, you know, for a lot of people, the idea of paying a higher tax bracket was more appealing than the idea of having their currency devaluated. So, you know, I think when people are presented with this idea that there's kind of a rock and a hard place and they have to choose, you know, and raising taxes can sometimes be the more appealing choice.
Although one of the big arguments against higher tax rates is that it'll cause more money to go offshore and starve entrepreneurs of capital. What does the research show?
Well, first of all, I think the entrepreneurial argument is kind of hogwash, because if you look at new business formation in entrepreneurship in America, it's been declining for the past two decades. And these are two decades in which taxes were actually cut for the rich. So I don't think that argument really holds water. In terms of the seeing money go offshore, I think that's certainly a valid argument. And I think if the government were to raise taxes, if they were to somehow find the political will to do so, they would have to change some of the regulations that make it more difficult to store money offshore. I mean, you see Congress already starting to do this. In 2010, the Foreign Account Tax Compliant Act was passed. There have been a lot of complaints about it, but I think economists would say it's a step in the right direction. And there's certainly a lot more that can be done with their be political will to do so, to prevent so much money from going offshore.
Well, regardless of what the data show, what we're talking about, there's the politics of raising taxes and higher taxes on the rich. People think of it as socialism. They didn't used to think that way.
Yeah, I think there's certainly more of a idea that kind of if you were really rich, perhaps the government helped you get there in some way and you maybe owed something back to the government for that. And so I think that's certainly changed. I mean, one of the interesting things is that certainly in the Gilded Age, this idea that we should raise taxes on the rich and redistribute wealth was seen as this left-wing, you know, kind of crazy ideology, especially in the late 1880s. Early 1900s, and this slowly started to change. You know, I don't know if that's what we're seeing now, but you certainly see campaigns like Bernie Sanders gaining a lot of steam, especially among young people. You know, it's not out of the question that this type of mentality that redistribution is actually a good idea could come back into vogue.
So the headline of your piece is the U.S. due for radically raising taxes for the rich. Is it? And what does due mean?
I think the smartest economists that I've talked to would say, yes, it is. It is time, and it's time to raise them more than just, you know, a couple of percentage points. You know, Obama was able to raise it, I believe, from 35% to 39.6%. I think the economists that I've talked to that I tend to agree with would say, you know, enough of this 4 percentage point increases, how about 20 percentage points or 30? And then we can see if it really has any effect.
And who are the rich in that equation?
It would be the top 1%. It's certainly a pretty small subgroup of people.
Alana Semuels, she's a staff writer at The Atlantic. Great talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, what should we do to alleviate income inequality? Is taxing the rich the answer? Let us know at 844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the last of the political conventions wrapped this weekend. The Green Party officially nominated Jill Stein. But what's the real goal of the Greens? That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave for Madeline Brand. There's some encouraging news if you're a third-party candidate this presidential election. The organizers for the upcoming presidential debates are planning for the possibility that a third-party candidate will join Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump on stage. Good news for supporters of the Green Party and their candidate Jill Stein. They held their convention this past weekend to nominate Stein. Elliot Nelson attended the convention, along with the RNC, the DNC, and the Libertarian Convention. He's a perfect 4 for 4 this year. He's a politics reporter for the Huffington Post. Hi, Elliot.
Thanks so much for having me, Barbara.
Well, let's start with the scene at the Green Convention in Houston. And apparently party members had to go to a McDonald's for lunch because it was the only place open. And it sounds like hilarity ensued. Tell us about
that. Well, yeah, that's right. This wasn't what you probably imagine when you think of political conventions. There were no arenas. There were no sprawling security apparatuses surrounding one. The Green Party actually held its convention in the Student Center in the University of Houston. And because it was actually held on a weekend, all of the various eateries that are usually open to the students there were closed, save, of course, for the GMO-loving corporatist McDonald's, which a number of Green Party attendees were forced to stomach down.
Right, and they would never go there, right? And the way you describe the Green Party, it does seem like it's long on outrage but short on organization, and I did enjoy this line that you wrote. Delegates spent nearly an hour on breathing exercises and aimless discussion about their anti-oppression skills.
That's right. The Green Party is sort of important to view as much, if not more, as a movement than a political party. And not unlike the Libertarian Party, the staunchly anti-government one, it's found itself in a peculiar situation this year where we have two mainstream party candidates with historically high unapproval ratings and a sudden spike in interest in third parties. And now what you've had the Green Party do is, as the Libertarians have as well, is engage in this conversation of whether to sort of broaden their tent and perhaps relax their views on certain issues or sort of toe the party line. What the Green Party has sort of done instead is kind of tried to tack itself on to the momentum found by Bernie Sanders during his presidential campaign during the Democratic primary. I think mostly to middling success, but it is something they're trying to go for.
And that begs the question, what is the Green platform exactly? What is towing the party line? Because they used to be centered on environmental issues, green issues, but that's evolved.
Yeah, it still very much is anchored in green issues. I mean, the party still expresses pretty staunch opposition to things like hydraulic fracking and expanding fossil fuel production. But to be honest, much of the Green Party platform that it actually passed this weekend, as well as nominating its presidential ticket, resembles something you might see from a pretty liberal Democratic candidate. Things like it supports single-payer health care, which sort of simply put is kind of Medicare for all. Jill Stein, the party's presidential nominee, is calling for a Green New Deal, which is a large investment in environmentally friendly infrastructure. Similar things like opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership and NAFTA, raising the national minimum wage. But where it starts to depart from the Democrats is in certain areas. For example, they want to reduce the defense budget by 50%, which isn't totally unheard of when you talk to Democrats. But even among some on the left in Congress, that's a bit beyond the pale. And they also want to institute reparations for the descendants of African slaves. And so it does sort of deviate somewhat strongly from the Democratic platform at times.
Well, aside from Jill Stein, who we talked to on the show last week, who are some of the other big figures aligning themselves with the Green Party this year?
Right. Well, probably the most well-known would be the academic and activist Cornel West, who is also a theologian and longtime political activist.
And he was a big Sanders supporter.
He was a big Sanders supporter, and he actually upset many in the Democratic Party. And this narrative goes back to the early and even pre-Obama administration, when he was a pretty staunch supporter of the president, and that relationship quickly soured after the president entered the Oval Office. West sort of criticized some of his foreign policy, has repeatedly attacked him as sort of a neoliberal perpetuator of the establishment. And the Democrats thought they had sort of made peace with West when he joined the Democrats' policy committee leading up to the convention several weeks ago, only afterwards to have West announce his endorsement for Stein.
Well, that's interesting. And it does seem that, as you say, the Libertarians and the Greens have somewhat in common in terms of values, but they're also very similar in terms of fighting for a seat at the table this year. So how do their campaign strategies compare, and are they playing nice with each other?
Well, I think with the Greens, you don't see quite the sort of flexibility, you might say, as you do with the Libertarians. Although Gary Johnson, the former governor of New Mexico, was nominated by his party. He was actually only nominated with about 50% of the Libertarian Party delegate support. That in part had to do with the view amongst many party activists that he wasn't staunchly anti-government enough. When I was covering that convention, there was one moment where a person had said that they didn't want to outlaw selling drugs to children, or rather they did, and that drew boos. So things like that sort of drew the ire of some doctrinaire members of his party. Whereas with the Greens, you see more universal support for Stein's candidacy, and that's in part because Stein, I think, is very intent on keeping true to the sort of pure green line. Now, in terms of strategy, what that shakes out to is you have Johnson tapping former Massachusetts Governor William Weld as his running mate, whereas Stein tapped a human rights activist, Ajemu Baraka, as hers. He's come under some pressure for saying some comments that were seen as sympathetic to Russia and at times conspiratorial. So with the Libertarians, I think you see a bit more outreach to the mainstream than you do with the Greens.
Elliot Nelson, he's a politics reporter for the Huffington Post and author of the forthcoming book, The Beltway Bible. That's due out in September. Thanks so much for this.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, fair income distribution can't come fast enough for some Nevada homeowners. 8 years after the housing bubble burst, they're still underwater in Las Vegas.
The point about Las Vegas is that it was just in such a deep trench that the people who bought at the crest of the wave are still pretty deep in a trough.
A place where the crisis never ended. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. You can keep up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand. Both presidential candidates are unveiling their economic plans this week in Detroit. Donald Trump spoke about his yesterday. Hillary Clinton rolls hers out there on Thursday. The economy has been a central issue in politics, especially since the housing bubble burst 8 years ago, plunging the U.S. into the greatest recession since the Great Depression. And the economic recovery, though relatively steady overall, has been sluggish and selective, affecting some more than others. So in some communities, when people hear politicians talk about whether the recovery has been fast enough or strong enough, they have good reason to wonder, recovery? What recovery? That's how many homeowners feel in Las Vegas, Nevada, one of the city's hardest hit by the subprime mortgage crisis. Jack Healy met with some of them and wrote about it for the New York Times, and it's good to talk with you on Press Play.
Thanks so much.
So you write about what you call a simple truth, and it's really a glittering promise in Las Vegas that the house always wins. Why don't you take us back to before the recession, when Vegas was booming and that phrase really was coined? What did it mean?
I mean, you know, I think that there's a certain dual meaning of it, right?
The house always wins. The casino
over time.
House yeah, always wins.
Exactly. But you just saw this incredible faith being bestowed on the relentless rise in home values and the fact that if you were able to put down 20% or sometimes 0% on a house and start making payments initially or just pay interest for a while, that you could essentially carve your way to a higher social status and instant equity and basically get rich. Construction in Las Vegas has always been sort of a tale of moving farther and farther out from the core of the city and the strip into the desert. And, you know, I wasn't physically there, personally there, during the boom times in 2005 and 6. But, you know, you read accounts and you talk to people and you hear about these lines for open houses and people calling realtors the day before new properties or new subdivisions would go onto the market. And there was just this sort of, you know, gold rush. And that you saw it all over the country, but you really saw incredible appreciations in home values in places like Vegas or down in Florida or just kind of, you know, exurban areas that, you know, previously had sort of been like these untapped sources of land that were suddenly getting parlayed into, you know, sources of wealth for people.
Right. Huge McMansions in the desert. And you really did see it in spades, so to speak, in Las Vegas. And one of the people that you describe who really believed, was a true believer, you describe in the story, Michael Hutchings. And he bought into the promise. Tell us about his rise and his fall in 2008.
Sure. I mean, so he made a living as a developer. He came from a background having, you know, grown up in a family of, you know, builders and developers. And he decided to, you know, build this kind of dream house on an undeveloped piece of land that looked west towards the Las Vegas Strip. It's probably about, you know, a 10-mile drive or so. And it kind of became a dream home for him. And he
had a pool, right? The whole thing.
And a guest house and the whole, I mean, just sort of anything that you could scribble onto the back of a napkin as you're, you know, sort of fantasizing about what your dream house might look like. And that was his, you know, just this beautiful sort of like terrazzo tiles in the kitchen and that sort of thing. And then as the housing crisis kind of took root, his income as a builder really dropped, and he, you know, ended up like so many people there, underwater on this house. And, you know, to be underwater, you know, was this phenomenon of basically owing more on the house than it perhaps was ever going to be worth. And that's kind of what attracted us to the city in the first place, is that it's had this persistent problem so many years after the crash. And there were buyers like Mr. Hutchings who, like, even 8 years after, were still in this position of saying, should we keep making these payments? Should we walk away? Should we keep fighting with our lenders? What should we do? It hasn't gotten better for us. You know, the rebound hasn't happened.
Right. And he's $580,000 into this house, right? This
exactly.
is where he is 8 years later. What is the house like? What's the neighborhood like? What's his quality of life like now?
Well, so the house is beautiful. I interviewed him and his wife, and, you know, amidst the sort of, you know, afternoon clamor of their two kids, you know, running around and playing and having pizza for dinner. And the house is incredibly beautiful. But I think to a certain extent, it's almost become a fortress for him and his wife. They say that the neighborhood has really declined as there have been sort of these waves of people moving out and some renters moving in or houses being left vacant. They say that crime has gone up in the area and that they are now getting accustomed to hearing gunshots intermittently, you know, coming from places elsewhere in the neighborhood, and that one property that had even been emptied out had been taken over by a renter who appeared to be running some sort of drug dealing operation, and this was a couple blocks away from them. So, you know, he has gotten extraordinarily scared for his safety and his family's safety, and he says that, for example, when he goes out to take his two kids to the park, they're 1 and 3 years old, that he puts on a handgun and he carries it with him when he goes.
And it's so horribly ironic because he built this house so that he'd have a view of the Strip, and now there are these new hotels and resorts popping up on the Strip that he's overlooking. Does the development trickle down to these people who were hardest hit by the housing bubble in Las Vegas?
Well, I think that the employment picture has certainly improved, but Vegas has lagged behind the rest of the country when it comes to unemployment, if I'm remembering right. The latest government stats had unemployment in Nevada at about 6.4%, you know, which is higher than the sort of just below 5% that we're looking at across the nation. And I would say, of course, that housing prices and housing values have certainly, you know, made what looks to be like quite a comeback from the pits of the recession when they were, I think, hovering around something like maybe $130,000 for an average house, and you know, there are just foreclosures everywhere, and just it was absolutely the dominant kind of sale in the market was a short sale or a foreclosure. I mean, today people are building again and people are buying again, but the point about Las Vegas is that it was just in such a deep trench that even as home values have come up, the people who bought at the crest of the wave or the people who, you know, made some unwise financial decisions and gambles, you know, are still pretty deep in a trough.
Well, Hutchins has stayed in his home rather than walk away from all that he's put into it. What about the other families you talked to who did leave their houses? How are they getting by? How are they doing now?
You know, there's this one woman who actually didn't make it into this particular story, who had an interesting short sale story. It was a case of her husband having died, and she was left with two kids and a vastly depleted income, you know, on this house that they had been just barely able to pay after having taken out a loan to turn their kitchen into sort of a dream kitchen and a backyard into a dream backyard and that sort of thing. She had to short sell her house, and she's now living in a rental with another mother who is in a very similar situation. So I think a lot of people have moved into rentals. Some people have doubled up with families, you know, and some people are still engaged in these what have become kind of years-long battles with their banks and their lenders to try to get home loan modifications or get an interest rate reduced from 8% where it had reset back down to 3 or 4 or something of that nature. You know, and they're still trying to stave off foreclosures.
I'm talking with Jack Healy. He's Rocky Mountain correspondent for The New York Times. He's writing a series about anxiety in America. Well, Michael Hutchins, this source for you in this story draws a really interesting parallel between choosing between two bad choices with his house, you know, whether to walk away or stay in this deteriorating neighborhood to protect his investment, and the choices he faces in this election between Trump and Clinton. Tell us more about that, how he talks about that.
Yeah, sort of the lens through which we're looking at a lot of these stories, which are trying to examine the roots of voters' anxieties and this kind of fraught moment in American politics is really sort of asking people sort of what's your economic situation and how is that influencing the way you're thinking about politics? And, you know, to him, the choice between Clinton and Trump was sort of just as bad. It was almost like this sort of lose-lose, you know, scenario. And Mr. Hutchins is a former Marine, and he's a pretty sort of dyed-in-the-wool Republican. But he had been really wrestling with Donald Trump as the nominee because he had sort of watched some of the more cavalier statements that Trump had made, and he just saw a sort of destabilizing presence in Trump. And he was still committed to voting for him the last time I talked to Mr. Hutchins, but he was kind of leery. He sort of thought that there could be some sort of whirlwind if Trump got into office. But yeah, I think that the crisis and sort of its duration in Las Vegas, at least for the people that I talked to, had really undermined a lot of people's faith in institutions. You know, there was this other couple, real strong Republicans, who lived on the north side of town, you know, NRA sticker on the back of their car and, you know, In God We Trust t-shirts and that kind of stuff. And yet they really kind of gave President Obama some credit for some of the intentions of the homeownership aid programs that he set up in the early days of the housing crisis. But they just sort of felt like these programs weren't helping people like them. And you would sort of hear that as you talk to people who were grappling with foreclosures, that a lot of people had been through various cycles of going to home modification places or had paid, you know, $3,000 to some agency that promised to get them a new loan or things of that nature. And they just hadn't seen results. And so there was this kind of sense of fatigue and frustration that was a real common note for a lot of the people that I was talking to.
And which can be a common theme for people who are still planning to vote for Donald Trump. And it seems like many of the people that you talk to in Las Vegas have a Trump story. What did they tell you? What did they speak about when they spoke of Trump?
Well, Hutchings had actually met him a couple times, because during some of his earlier days in the world of real estate development, he had gone to some realtor's party or something, and Trump had been there and had signed a copy of his book, and that interaction had sort of convinced him in some ways that Trump was a little bit less of a showboat perhaps than he appeared to be on TV. I had a really fun conversation with the mayor of Las Vegas, who is actually, the last time I spoke with her, still undecided about who to vote for. And she described, this meeting that she and her husband, who is then the mayor, had with Donald Trump about 10 or 15 years ago, in which they sat down to talk about this redevelopment project in Vegas. And Trump had insisted that there had to be one aesthetic, that it couldn't be this sort of vision of multiple architectural and aesthetic styles, that it had to be sort of one way. And that sort of was very prescient, I guess, to the way some of the things that we've learned about him since.
What was your takeaway coming away from Las Vegas? Because there's so many takeaways from the housing crisis. And one of them is that our institutions betrayed the home buyers. And the other is the home buyers believed in a free lunch as well, that we all fooled ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of the people that I spoke with were people who had made unquestionably poor or incredibly risky financial decisions and had, kind of bet the house on the house. What was so intriguing for us about this place was that Vegas had sort of been the pit of the housing crisis, and that values had sort of stayed so low for so long, and it had been such a drag on the economy for so long, that to check back in with like the one out of four people who was still sort of underwater was kind of in some ways like a fundamental question about, one of the tenets of the American dream, of like home ownership. And I think there was sort of a lot of fundamental questioning about whether that was the best way to invest your money, or that was the best way to gain some sense of financial stability. And people were trying to sort of figure out what they would do if not buy a home. Like, where would they put the money? There was a lot of distrust in stock markets, or the sense that the banks were gaming all of Wall Street and that sort of thing. So there was a real just sort of wariness of institutions that I was running into.
Jack Healy's Rocky Mountain correspondent for the New York Times, and you can read the third installment in this series about anxiety in America this week. And it was great talking with you. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Coming up here on Press Play, it seems like you can't swing a dead cat in L.A. without hitting a platter of charcuterie, the perfect cured and pickled tidbits for your next picnic at the Hollywood Bowl. That's next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. There's always some new food trend sweeping L.A., right? Whether it's some fabulous thingy wrapped in bacon or bone broth in a cup fashioned from a zucchini or something. That is all well and good, but the beautiful thing about a good charcuterie, it can encompass every trend, especially here in Los Angeles. From a Vietnamese spin on the classic platter to good old-fashioned prosciutto, you just add rosé and there you have it, the perfect summer starter. Madeline Brand spoke with LA Weekly food editor Catherine Spires recently about charcuterie, and she started by asking her if there are rules for what makes up a proper charcuterie plate.
Well, it's French food. Of course there are rules. And we should say that salumi, not salami, but salumi is just the Italian version of that, and it more or less means the same thing. So whether it's a salumi plate or a charcuterie plate, you're getting the same thing. It's just whether it's French-influenced or Italian-influenced.
But different meats?
Well, different names of the meats, but they both heavily rely on pork. That's not a rule. It just happens to usually be pork for both of them. And it's cured meats, it's potted meats, like chicken liver mousse, something like that. Mm-hmm. There's the rare non-pork.
Like a pate.
Yeah, and a pate, a terrine, prosciutto.
Now, what's the difference between a terrine and a pate?
Okay, it's the different, there's this really gross word, force meat. And force meat refers to actually the way that they process it. And there's different levels to the grind. You can do a really smooth one, mm-hmm. and that'll get you a mousse. If you're doing more of like a chunky chop, that's what you do with a terrine.
Okay.
Yeah. But
and
both of
why
them
would you want to do a terrine versus a mousse?
Oh, just playing with textures, mm-hmm. Different ways of eating it.
And different, I guess, different meats are better for one or the other.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you're putting together a charcuterie plate, you want to have all the different textures represented in different flavors. So, yeah, you know, try different things out.
So when you're putting together a plate, it has to have, according to the rules, what?
Well, it should have one thing in a pot, so that'll uh-huh. usually be the mousse. It should have a terrine. It'll just be a slice of the terrine, not the whole thing. Uh-huh. So you'll get this sort of, I mean, we could call it an aspic. It's just, it sounds better to call it a terrine. You want to make sure that there's really only one element of something with that's smoked. So only one smoky flavor, otherwise it overpowers everything else. And then you want to get a cured meat that's called whole muscle. And that would be something like the prosciutto or the Iberico ham, where they just do the slices of it. That's the basics. And then a lot of people sort of fancy it up with a mustard, maybe a sweet mustard and a hot mustard. You can have some nuts in there just for a textural difference.
A little cornichon.
Oh, of course. A little palate cleanser.
And bread?
Yeah, it's not necessary. And there are people who will say don't like muddle the flavor with bread. But charcuterie is often also paired with cheese. And so you can make yourself a little open face sandwich. Why not?
Well, then you've got a meal. But and what are you going to do with your pâté? You're not going to just eat that out of the
I've seen people do it. Hmm. You know, people have their different taste buds. Okay. But I agree.
But you can do, so you said usually pork, but you can do duck or goose as well.
Yeah, you certainly can. And actually, there's this charcuterie plate at Casilla in Santa Monica, and that is heavily Southeast Asian, but they do a charcuterie plate, and it's amazing. And one of the beauties of it is that it's not just all pork. They also have duck and lamb represented on it, and they kind of, I will admit, that Vietnamese might be my favorite kind of food, but the way they present it with the different herbs that you would have with pho or bún and the pickled cabbage that they have in the middle, and it's unexpected flavors because when you think charcuterie, you aren't thinking like curry, but that's represented there. Singaporean style bacon, which is really sweet and really quite spicy, and it's all delicious. So I really like what they've got going on.
Well, speaking of bacon, you don't often see bacon on a charcuterie.
No, not bacon in the way that we think of it, but the more the pork belly that's dried.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll show up occasionally.
Similar.
Yeah, but just not how we think of bacon.
Right, mm-hmm. Okay, so there are restaurants now that are curing their own meats. There are just meat-centric restaurants everywhere.
Yeah, I was looking at the timeline of when these charcuterie-focused restaurants started opening. And it was right around the same time that Dana Goodyear's book, Anything That Moves, came out. And she talked a lot about the sort of emerging masculinity of food culture, especially in Los Angeles, and how it was extremely meat-focused. And she was writing that book right when Bestia and Kisbaka were opening up. And those are both, I would say, the two restaurants that really kicked off charcuterie as a trend in Los Angeles, because they were the first ones to really promote how they were doing it in-house by their big, burly, tattooed man chefs.
You have to be a big, burly man to work there?
I don't think you do. It certainly seems to coincide a lot with it.
There's another restaurant that's new that seems to embody this, and it's called Cannibal.
Yeah. I mean, they really went for it with the name. And that one has a prior location in New York, but they've opened recently in Culver City. I really like their honesty, because some places will sort of muddle the language around whether they make their charcuterie in-house. But the Cannibal says they're cured charcuterie. They're bringing all of that in from other places. They just do what they call the fresh charcuterie, which includes the pâtés and the mousse and the terrine and the rillettes and all that sort of stuff.
And you can't have smoked fish involved in this.
Totally different thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Never the twain shall meet on the same plate.
I don't think so. I don't know if even in France there's laws against it.
There probably are.
Yeah, you're probably right. But yeah, I can't think of an instance where I saw that. It's usually, I mean, we sort of think of cured fish in LA as sort of a breakfast thing, don't we?
Well, gravlax.
That's true, but do a lot of Angelenos think of that?
No, probably not. But why not have a cured fish plate?
I say go for it. That would be very LA. Do whatever you want. Put whatever you want on there.
Okay, yeah. I'm doing it then.
All right.
You said I could. Okay, so let's say you want to get a charcuterie and bring it as a picnic or something like that. Are there places to go to get them to go already pre-made?
Yeah, I mean, you can call a place, something like Huntington Meats, and ask what kind of basket they have. They're not going to have it already set out. It would have to be made to order to, you know, preserve mm-hmm. the cured freshness of it all. But that location, and then also McCall's and Los Feliz would be a good place to get it. But because it's becoming more common, you can also get pretty much everything you need for a good charcuterie plate at a grocery store like Gelson's. Perhaps, definitely the upscale. And if you don't care about the sourcing and the origin, get one at Ralph's or Vaughn's. You know, why not? A little boar's head salami. You know, start with
maybe
that.
Some Lunchables.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, Lunchables are charcuterie. You just figured something out. That's amazing.
Okay. I just snobbified Lunchables.
I love it. I love it so much.
All right, Catherine, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Catherine Spires, food editor at LA Weekly and host of the podcast, How It Got in Your Mouth.
Jolie Myers, I don't know how you're going to follow up that. But
well, I have a question, Barbara.
What is
pizza
that?
Lunchable? Still charcuterie?
Oh, it is so much better than charcuterie.
Well, there's some sort of amalgamated meat product that comes on top of the pizza Lunchable.
Well, of course, that's what a Lunchable is.
Yeah.
That's just a little bit of paradise there on a cracker.
That was like squad goals when I was little, was scoring the Lunchable with like the little Snickers and the Capri Sun.
My children have never forgiven me for not letting them have Lunchables.
Wait, you were that parent?
I was that
Come
parent.
Come on,
I'm
Barbara.
Sorry. Come on.
They're over 18 now, so they can have all the Lunchables they
they're
want,
They're
so right?
getting back at me with Lunchables
Did they
and
Snapchat
Pop-Tarts.
Pictures of the like the bologna Lunchables to you? Does one Snapchat to someone else?
I'm talking six. You really don't want your six-year-old on Snapchat, but good try.
Accurate. Okay, so besides Lunchables, we talked about income inequality
we
today.
We did, and I'm curious what people thought about it.
Right, so Otto BVS says that the fact that the 1% are now controlling about 22% of income, we've reached a threshold of inequality that is undermining the economy rather than bolstering part of a dynamic capitalist system. Good engagement there. And someone named Potato says that income inequality is minor compared to wealth inequality, and we need to tell people the difference, which is wealth is your balance sheet, basically everything that you own that has money versus your debts.
That is a good point. And somehow it's significant that they're named Potato. It seems to fit in there.
Potato Lunchable.
But that'll do it for us for today. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow here on KCRW and KCRW.com.